My guest today is Midlands-based filmmaker Tom Lee Rutter, director of the acid western Day of the Stranger, the folk horror Bella in the Witch Helm, and the upcoming feature film Pocket Film of Superstitions that features horror icons such as Caroline Munro. In this podcast, we talk about no-budget filmmaking challenges, what it's like to make films primarily in the Black Country and the Midlands, and Tom's personal approach to creativity.
So I'm from Wolverhampton, and I've got strong links in the area still through family and the football, and I spend a lot of time there and in the Midlands, but I haven't made films there for about 20 years, and I almost exclusively now make my films in Kent. What are the challenges, Tom, in making a film in the Black Country and in the Midlands, which is, quite frankly, an area not known for lots of filmmaking?
I mean, for me, it's just a case of if you find something that you like, then you just go and ask, don't you? You know, and you're either going to meet someone who says, oh, absolutely, you know, they love the sound of this, or you're going to have folks, which will probably get everywhere, to be honest, is that if they see that you're making a film, then they assume that you've got money and they'll just try it on. And, you know, I have to kind of, you know, when I email somebody about a location, you know, I have to really tell them that I'm just a guy with a camera and, you know, a couple of actors. I'm not production company. I'm not this, that, the other. And hopefully they'll just, you know, show mercy and let us film there. But people around the Black Country way, I guess it's mad how, when I dip into it now, how much I kind of miss it, because it's just the old sensibility of the Black Country way and whatnot, just the general outlook. You know, it can be quite blunt, but also, you know, kind of salt of the earth. And there's still a lot of, you know, they are doing up a lot of places that used to be really quite industrial looking and quite bleak, and there are a lot of places, you know, getting knocked down and getting built up again. But for the most part, it's still there, and there's still loads of little gems to find, I think, because, as you say, not much is happening in the Black Country in terms of, I suppose, major filmmaking. I mean, there's a lot of indie stuff going on under the surface somewhere. I guess a lot of people aren't really just wise to the fact that people want to film places, so they will let you just do it, I guess, you know.
So you tend to have a small team, is one thing I've noticed. I've watched several of your films now, and you've got the same makeup artists that come back, some of the same cast get replaced. So is it just a case of you then, you've got your core team, the only thing that you really need to find that's new is things like the locations?
Yeah, absolutely that, really. I mean, because I'm in Kidderminster, and in Kidderminster, there's actually quite a nice little scene going on. There's at least five of us making films off our own back, doing our own thing. And we just help each other out, you know. One of my close friends, Baz, he makes films. He lives 10 minutes walk from me. So we're constantly helping each other out, which means we share a core circle of actors as well as people just doing each other favours. And a lot of the time it is just me and whichever actor's in a scene, you know, because I just come from this kind of DIY guerrilla school of filmmaking where if I see it, I want to just film it immediately. I just, you know, rather than try and communicate it with so many people, I've just got to have that personal experience of just capturing an image and manipulating it and maybe even telling some sort of story or sequence. And that's just usually because I have to do it so quickly and so kind of spontaneously. That it just takes too long to, you know, communicate with all of us, I guess. I mean, in the case of locations and whatnot, you know, sometimes you really do have to get in there and out very quickly. So,
is that because you've the permission only gives you an hour or two to film, or because you haven't asked for permission in the first place?
What well, that has happened in the past. I mean, lately, because I'm doing a film which requires a lot of period locations, it's a case of going back to what I was saying, finding the museums or the properties that aren't so into making money off everyone and understand what you're doing and want to support it, you know. But yesterday we were at a location where I initially thought we had it all day. So I was kind of living the dream, really, thinking I've got all this time. And then they told me that they've got a wake there at 2. So they were like, if you could be out by one, that'd be great. And I'm thinking, I've got about three scenes to do here. So, yeah, you can imagine how kind of rushed I was. I was just running around nonstop with a camera in my hand. And but it all went down okay in the end.
So, yeah, let me ask you about that, because we'll talk about your individual films that I've seen in a minute. But they all tend to be set in period times or in other places. We've got one film we'll talk about in a bit called Day of the Stranger, which is a Western, right, which I'm really interested in talking to you about. So why do you make films in this? Why do you make period set movies?
I think because I'm such a fan of watching guerrilla films and DIY films, I just like it when they try a little bit harder and set it somewhere where it's quite ridiculous that, you know, no one else would even imagine to do so because of the budget that it would entail and the locations and whatnot. Well, it didn't stop the likes of Michael J. Murphy, who you know, and seeing some of his films in particular was just like that complete indie spirit of, I don't care if I've got no money, I want to make a sword and sandal fantasy epic. and it didn't stop him. And you know, I can see past all the shoddy effects, because for the most part I love those anyway. But I can see that he's trying to tell a story, and I look at the story because, you know, I'm just an experienced viewer of, I suppose, underground stuff and indie stuff. So I don't mind all that. To the casual eye, I guess it's a nightmare because it just looks so low budget. But that, I just thought, I want to be like that, you know. I want to make films that are quite ridiculous, but you know, it just shows that someone's ambitious enough to try with nothing, you know. I think, well, that's something I'd want to watch anyway. So
yeah, and I think it's fair to say, this is not just me buttering you up, but your sense of the period is often superb, right? Particularly in those ones where you are doing a lot of post-production work. You don't just film in the location. All your films that I've seen tend to rely heavily on post-production work and
absolutely
and grading and things like that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's actually a nightmare sometimes, because some actors would like some showreel stuff, and I'm just like, I can't really give you that yet, because the film is literally in pieces, it's in tatters, you know, and it takes one key element to tie it up sometimes. And I guess, again, going back to what Michael J. Murphy was doing when he was matting in pieces into a shot, or whether he's using a different shot as a composite, or if he's using a photograph and putting the photograph in front of the camera lens, I just think that's a genius way of building a world, you know, with literally like some scissors and some paper. Like, and I wanted to just do that stuff, but on the timeline, you know, and I thought, well, you can use the same kind of principle, but in a different technique and do it digitally. So I've been kind of tinkering a lot with that, and hopefully going a bit further with it, you know.
Yes,
and it's just like, you know.
Certainly with your film, Bella in Witch Elm, which you made last year, I think.
Well, that came out originally in 2017, but because of the lockdown, first lockdown, I decided to recut it and remaster it, basically. So it's kind of re-released last year, this year. I can't remember, my brain's a bit mush. I think it was this year we relaunched it, actually, yeah.
Well, for those who don't know, it's a kind of almost a kind of uniquely Midland set tale, the kind of folk tale set in the past. And it was based on a story that appeared in the Express and Star. Was that a genuine story? The Express and Star is a local newspaper in Warren.
That's right, yeah, yeah. Stourbridge News, all these, you know, all these old running newspapers, they all ran the story, you know. And to even get a lot of the Express and Star articles, I got the train to Wolverhampton. I think it's the Resource Centre, not far from the football ground, actually, possibly. And it's where you can just go and spool through the old newspaper archives, you know. And I got printouts of all of them. I was there trying to find the dates, you know. And there it was. It was amazing, because then it just gave me all this information. So I decided to just lift a lot of that verbatim, really, because it's that kind of, it just worked for the narrative style of just like hearsay, you know, and the folkloric side of it. And, you know, the printed word's always got a different detail in it to what, you know, what's been previously said, that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, it's a very moody kind of story, and there's long stretches of just music and image, and it's got a very literary style. It's almost like, it seemed like a kind of film, almost a filmed poem or a filmed folk tale. more than a kind of scripted horror movie. Can you tell us a little bit about the origins of Bella and Witch Elm?
Well, yeah. Basically, we started shooting the Western in 2014, and all the troubles that came with filmmaking came at once, and I just needed to walk away from it because I didn't quite know how to resolve it. And then I started researching more into the Bella case. So my friend told me about the graffiti side of it, and then I'd ask my folks about it, and then they all knew about it. So it was always there, you know, such a popular story. And the Black Country Bugle would often run a good article on it as well, you know. So I just started researching that, and I thought, how can I approach this? Because I obviously want it to be a bit arty and a bit more, you know, offbeat, because what scared me growing up was watching a lot of these old, you know, like supernatural documentaries, like that, you know, on TV, where they would actually quite scare you, you know. But then in this day and age, there's all these like really horrible editing techniques that they use now, where they just take the scare out of anything in the atmosphere. It's just information overload, isn't it? So I wanted to go back and do something a bit quieter and a bit more, you know, gentle, but still kind of scary. And I just figured, well, a kind of hazy black and white look would kind of give it this dreamlike aesthetic, as well as kind of hark back to early cinema, and then have someone with a really thick Black Country accent narrate it, and kind of make it so regional in that way that if people struggle to understand it, then it'd be tough luck.
One thing that I noticed, I'm curious about the responses you had to that film, because I think that those local Black Country references and the local references, the Expresso Star newspaper, you made it very specific to the region. But I think that gives the film an incredible richness, even if you don't understand the references, right? It's like an entire world that's built up that you're setting. You're not having to create the world from nothing. You're locating your movie in a world that already exists. So what sort of responses did you have to that film? And did anyone mention the local references? Did it get an international release, or did it make any international festivals?
It played one American festival, I think, and I think it might have played another one, I can't remember. But generally, I've just been sending the film myself because I just thought, well, it's a really awkward running time for a film. It's 35 minutes, you know, and a lot of festivals don't really go for that. And I figured, well, because it's 35 minutes, it's still kind of at a length that I feel like I can sell myself, you know. I thought, if I can put it out my way as well and make it look really quite worth owning with all the little kind of like, you know, features you get with it, that it would fly as a, like, you know, as a nice little independent little art piece, you know. And it got really good reviews for, you know, for a film made with nothing. I think they saw that it did have like a bit of heart and soul at the core of it, you know, and that we're coming from a place and a time and we're trying to evoke some sort of, you know, way of being that's quite lost to a lot of other people, because obviously different regions have their different, you know, ways, but the core of it, there's this quaint humanity to it all, you know, and it's like the idea that someone's scaring you around a fire, and I think people responded to that well, you know. I just think they got that. It's still a very niche thing, but I think people would, you know, I've just found that a lot of people got into it who wouldn't usually watch kind of low budget horror films, because I was kind of aiming at an almost heritage market as well as an indie film crowd market. So I guess it hit those circles, you know.
What was the production schedule on that film? Because I'm guessing the post-production would have taken a lot longer. I know you said you recut it because of the lockdown. How long would you say it took in terms of labour hours did you put into making that movie?
I think all in all, excuse me, I think it was about a year and a half maybe, because I'd be editing as I go along, you know. And then the more I'd be editing, the more I'd revise the look or whatnot. And then I kind of just ended up settling on a look, which, you know, further down the line, I realised, oh, I've actually learned some more tricks since then that I can recut this and make it look better. But at the time, I think it was all in all about a year and a half, which isn't bad. But when, you know, this is in between full-time work and whatnot, you know. So it was a kind of as and when thing. Whereas if I would have scheduled it all together, we probably would have took, I don't know, 2 weeks. A lot of it was down to planning as well, because, you know, for instance, with the police station, we wanted a wartime police station. And I thought, well, how are we going to find one of those? So there's a lot of scouring around on the internet and asking people and people can put you in touch with people and all that. And, you know, people came through in the end and it was really good. So it was a lot of waiting around for that, which is kind of the situation I'm in now. But, you know, it's worth it when you do find what you want, isn't it? You know.
You said that's the situation you're in now. Is that with your new film that you're making?
Yeah. The thing is, going back to what I was saying, it's with the ambition of making, you know, different worlds with no money, you get to a point, I'm sure you'll agree, where you want to make a film and you've written this into the film and you want it and you know you can get it and you think, why shouldn't I be able to get that? You know, you're constantly challenging yourself to attain these places or these items. So it's a little task you set yourself. I'm sure you'll agree, because I think every film you make, you want to get more ambitious with the next one, don't you? You know,
I think there's definitely that. That's definitely the drive. I think there's an element with me where sometimes it can make my writing a little bit more hesitant, because I like the idea of having everything to hand and knowing that I can actually make it. So sometimes, you know, and I wonder whether I stifle my ambition a little bit sometimes of thinking, well, that prop, that location is a little bit too hard to find, so maybe I won't write that scene in, which can be restricting actually. But you're saying that you kind of go the other way around. You write it, then you go and find what you need.
Oh, in a way, I mean, it's more, it's also, again, a lot of what you do, but it's also seeing a place and thinking, I want that place, you know, I'm going to write something about that place and then I'm going to try and get it. And then sometimes that place falls through, so you just have to find elsewhere to make it work.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the scenes I did yesterday, I went for about 5 different location changes before we settled on this one, you know, for the scene. It was just almost like, okay, we've got a day in a location, let's do it there. You know, so it is a bit of both. I mean, a lot of the, I rarely kind of conjure up images in my mind and think, oh yeah, we're gonna film that, you know. It's usually because I've seen somewhere where I think that's possible, or this is possible and that's possible, and we can make that possible, but you know, we'll see about that further down the line, you know.
So when we talk about your new film, is this the Pocket Full of Superstitions? Is this the trailer?
Yeah, the Pocket Film, that's it. The Pocket Film of Superstitions. A lot of people say it's an anthology, but it's actually not. It's an almanac. So I'm being like kind of semi-awkward, because it isn't really an anthology of stories. It's just a series of vignettes, you know, and sketches, but kind of delivered in the style of with a narrator, basically just telling us about different superstitions through the ages. It's basically just an excuse to play with loads of really exciting little scenes, you know, and also just to create a diversity and hopefully not bore the audience with the fact that there's no plot. But it was born out of a necessity, really, to bring actors in and out for the day rather than calling them back. And it was also a case of, if we can get a set piece done a day, then it's wave goodbye to the actors, thank them for their services, and then they're on the cast list. And as a result, I've got a really amazing cast, like, you know.
Yeah, did I see Caroline Munro in the trailer?
Yes, yeah, we got Caroline Munro. And since that trailer, we got Lynn Lowry as well, from Shivers and The Crazies. And then yesterday we filmed with Danny Thompson, so we got some of the new blood in there as well, you know, for the... Because she's like, you know, such a hard-working current UK scream queen that... It'd be rude not to get her as involved as part of the party, you know.
What was it like working with these name actors who've got such experience in horror?
Well, with Caroline Munro, that was kind of like, you know, basically much like every other shoot I do, I'm just an absolute bag of nerves, and I'm just hoping that I just make a good impression with someone I respect so much. And Caroline is literally the one of the most beautiful people you'll ever meet, you know. She's not a diva. She's just so gentle and just, you know, lets you do your thing. And she's just a consummate pro, as you can imagine. You know, she'll just do exactly what you want without you even having to tell her. She was going through a bad time as well at the time. She recently lost her husband, and she was, you know, she could have pulled out and it would have been totally understandable, but she didn't. She wanted to kind of keep her head above water and still take on the work. But we gave her a good day, because, you know, there wasn't really much to do other than just for Caroline to be Caroline behind her kind of like her altar, you know, with her cauldron and whatnot. And because it was a situation where I'd get her shots then and get the rest of the shots for the scene at another point, which I still haven't done because of what's been happening. And so it just basically made, it gave us all a sense of ease. You know, we didn't have to get through so much. We just got enough time to spend, just get as many shots as we could of Caroline. And she was really happy to do it, you know. So I really highly recommend working with her.
Fantastic. So is that film, so A Pocket Film of Superstitions, is that a feature film or is it going to be about 35-minute length?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely going to be feature. But it's because basically I really liked kind of like some of the approach to Bella with its kind of hazy black and white kind of. So I thought I want to just do that on a bigger scale. But I don't want to kind of strike twice and do another folk tale that's like local. Or so I just thought, well, rather than do another story, just go a bit more broad and just do an almanac of superstition. So it's got no plot to speak of, but loads of entertaining little scenes, hopefully, you know. So it's a big experiment. We'll have to just wait and see how it turns out.
Like, as with all of this, for those listening to the podcast, in the description, I'll put links to the trailers for these movies. But it's very much seems like it's linked in style to Bella and Witch Elm. It seems like an evolution out of the work that you were doing on that.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's kind of where I'd like to go, and just to see how far I can take it, you know, with these aesthetics and how differently I can deliver them each time. And I just think they'd kind of be nice films to sit next to each other as well. So it is quite nice to be finding a style that you like and just to see where it takes you, you know. Because I really like the stark black and white of your film, which again I see as part of that, you know, as part of that lineup, that evolutionary lineup, that stylistic lineup, you know. I just think it works because there's nuns in there. It's got that stark gothic look about it, you know. We talked about the Redemption Films label, and again, that imagery, that all just filters into what I love. So it's down to the line of, like, you know, gothic horror and anything in that realm of, like, dark black and white nightmarish, you know. So we'll see where it goes. So
talking about style and aesthetics then, let's talk a little bit about your film Day of the Stranger, which is available from Darkside Releasing on video on demand and on Blu-ray. And this is a Western, right? So not only are you making films in the Midlands, right? You're making fucking Westerns in the Midlands, right? Which is sounds insane. And it's quite a mad film. And I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, right? It's an insane film. You went for very much the acid Western style. So, tell us something about what prompted you to make Day of the Stranger and some of the issues that you had with it. And your relationship with it. You've mentioned you've got a bad relationship with that film. Tell us something about that.
Yeah, I've got a pretty strange relationship with that one. It was just born out of the fact that, you know, I was bored and I'd made a film for a while, you know, and living in Kiddy, we're going to visit a friend up towards the Worcestershire Road, from Stourport, and you go past Hartbury Common. And it's just full of sandstone, you know, sand on the floor, sandstone formation, nice blue sky above it. And I just think, wow, you could film a Western there, you know. And then we did one day of the filming back in 2014 in April, when we had a kind of uncharacteristic heat wave. And we just came back with a day of footage and thought, well, I suppose we build a film around this now. And then we kind of got other actors involved because it was literally just me and my mates, you know. We were just, well, let's just go out. And then other actors started getting involved, and then, you know, even more, I suppose, more plot lines started getting involved, or more, you know, other characters would have to be introduced if we're going to flesh out. Because initially I wanted to just do a two-hander, keep it simple. But then I suppose, you know, if you want to tell a story, you've got to add different characters, different dynamics and whatnot. And then we just ended up filming, and then I realised I didn't like the footage, so we'd film again, and then realised, basically, we were kind of filming after, like, a really rough first draft. I didn't give myself time to revise it or anything, and we just decided to just go out and do it. It was just all in, going back to what I was saying about being a DIY gorilla, you know, go out and shoot something. It was all in the spirit of that, really, so I guess we'd look at the problems later, of which there turned out to be many, you know.
And the problems then, what do you think the problems are with that film?
Well, again, I suppose it was just getting, just trying too hard to make something a bit ambitious, and then eventually having the fact that we didn't have any resources just kind of like, you know, stall us. And then we had problems with the one of the lead actors who played the stranger. He turned out to be quite erratic, and eventually he walked, and then well, I just thought the film was dead then, because he wasn't very good in the role either, and the kind of the role I'd written, it was filled by someone who just said they wanted to do it. So I didn't really give it any thought, but just get him involved. And then as a result of him getting involved, it opened up, you know, opportunities to get other bits shot, which, you know, so it became a double-edged sword in that way. And then he eventually things blew up and he walked, basically. He was gone. And then I had already started filming the Pocket Film of Superstitions around 2018. And then one of the guys I'd worked with on that, we brought him in to play the lead actor, the stranger. And that meant the 3 years that we spent on and off filming with this other guy, we did with the new actor in like 2 or 3 days, which was absolutely nuts. You know, I mean, we got him up from the London area, and he kept at mine, and we just did 2 solid days of filming, reshooting the scenes, and he just did it. I mean, you know, and he did it really well. Really couldn't ask for anything more. I thought he was absolutely amazing and all. As for why make a Western in the first place all round, I don't know. I question that all the time.
Well, I think you might be there, just said the location, because that location you're talking about, when I was at college long, long, long time ago, a friend of mine tried to make a kind of Mad Max ripoff in that exact same location that you're talking about. He had people
wearing leather jackets. Really?
Yeah, obviously no cars, but like post-apocalyptic, as if it was that kind of thing. So that was where I'd seen that location before.
Wow. Did any of that survive? Is it still around, that film?
No, I don't know that person anymore. And I, from what I recall, I don't know if it ever got finished, but it was about 20, 25 minutes worth. And this would have been about 1993.
Wow.
So going back a long time. Right.
Well, I just love rooting out all these old little lost gems of indie filmmaking, because they're all out there, you know. And if you think someone's been, if you find out someone's been doing it in the area that you've been doing it before, you want to know about it, don't you? You know.
But it's interesting how that location prompts the genre, right? So you got the location there, so yeah. It might be a good example. You shot some of the stuff in Wales for Day of the Stranger as well.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, because we went camping over at Shell Island. You know, I don't know if you've been to Shell Island, but. It is all just sand dunes, and obviously when you're there, you know, your filmmaker brain just going, wow, I could film all sorts of, we could do a Star Wars film here, you know. And it just turned out to be the ideal place to just, you know, stick a cowboy in the middle of, you know, because obviously I'm a big fan of, yeah, like the films of Jodorowsky, like El Topo, and El Topo is just one of those films that just blows your mind, you know. I don't know if you agree, but if I want to make a film now, I mean, there's a lot of kind of urgency to make commercially viable indie films these days, which to me just spoils the fun of indie, you know. So you go to Tesco Express and there's Tesco or, you know, one of the other supermarkets, and the DVDs on the shelf, a lot of them are in British indie films, which is amazing, you know. It's incredible that there's that outlet to make it work, but it also means a lot of the labels are dictating what kind of content they want, and they want mockbusters for the most part, you know, and things like that. If it gets them to keep making films, then so be it, but I just think I'd like to offer something completely different. And while I've got no money and no one's telling me what to do, I'm going to make just the craziest films I can possibly make, you know, and just fill in that little gap in the market and say, well, you know, no one's made a British acid Western, so let's do that, you know.
Well, what I really like about the film, apart from the locations, that there's some really interesting gunplay you've got in there as well. And where did you get the, how was that finding the props and sourcing the props and the costumes and stuff for that film?
Well, to be fair, it was all pretty simple. I mean, it was just like leather waistcoats and my friend James, who was in the first scene of the film as the doomed bounty, he had loads of hats. So originally he was the hat guy, and then he became one of the actors, and then, you know, he's been on like all of our shoots pretty much ever since, you know. So he provided most of the hats, and then it was just a case of get a shirt, some a waistcoat, and a couple of holsters, and literally we ended up using just toy guns, you know. And I look at it now, I'm like, we should have made more effort to get some better guns in and stuff. But there you go.
Yeah, there's a lack of horses as well. But
oh yeah, the lack of horses, which is something I love. Like, it just makes me laugh so much. I mean, it reminds me of Hannibal the Musical. Have you seen that? You know, there's like one horse at the start, and then the horse gets stolen. So like the rest of the film, there's just no horses in it, and it's like they knew the score. They knew horses were trouble, so they just cut the horses out of the equation. Or even, you know, Monty Python's Holy Grail. You know, with the coconuts. I think we just got like a couple of shots of stop motion horse riding, didn't we? And that was it. We just totally cut the idea of horses out. We were going to shoot some horses, but it just didn't happen. You know, it's just one of those things. There's still a list of stuff to have shot before I decided, now I'm going to finish the film as is, you know.
And so let's talk about a little bit about maybe funding is the right word. Let's talk about allocation of resources or whatever kind of money that you have. Do you're self-funding these films? Any of the sales that you make from any of your films, do you put it back into your own movies? And what's the kind of allocation of resources here? How much do you put onto kind of cast expenses, props, locations? How much is borrowed and stolen and begged? And what's the allocation of funding that you might have?
Well, see, Day of the Stranger was like, you know, very bare bones. I mean, the actors would chip in and I'd chip in with what I can. And there was a lot of begging and borrowing. But it was, again, a case of going to a lot of locations that were free to go to, you know. So, and the clothes didn't really... It was just, again, shirts, waistcoats, whatever we could find in charity shops. So that was very little, really. Whereas with the Pocket Film of Superstitions, it's become such an expensive film for me that, you know, I'm kind of... I get paid monthly with my job, so it's like, how much of that money can I allocate to a shoot? And then when you do make money off the other films, you know, you blow that on one big asset, and then obviously you've got to make more money again to spend it again and whatnot. So with the Superstitions, in the case of Superstitions, it's like each, I've made so that certain each segment has at least two or, you know, one, two assets to, you know, to show off. Like in the case of getting Caroline Monroe in, she was the asset for 1 month's worth of filmmaking because she was obviously going to cost all of my resources for that month. But it was worth it because then I've got her in the bank, you know, and I haven't got to worry about her coming back. So then it'd be a case of negotiating with locations. Some people want more money than you'd want to pay, but you really need that location. You really want the footage. So you don't, you know, the location becomes the asset for that month and everything else has to get in there for free, you know. And it's sometimes a really difficult to, you know, juggle. In the case of actors, though, I mean, you know, even if we were unable to pay actors, we just make sure they wouldn't put their hand in their pockets and give them a good time and just make sure they're fed and happy, really, and just make sure that it's not of any consequence to their lives, you know.
Yeah. Do you have much rehearsal time with actors? Do you factor in rehearsal time for either your own camera work or anything else that's happening on set or for the use of the actors?
I think I probably should do when it comes to me, but I haven't really, apart from the Western, really, I haven't really made anything with kind of, you know, really dramatic scenes with dialogue, you know, with actors, because I've kind of gone the easy way out and done, you know, films with narrators and stuff like that. Whereas I do want to spend more time, but that boils down to the frustration of making films the way I do. I do want to kind of, you know, graduate into making budgeted films with in a short amount of time rather than spending 6 years like Day of the Stranger inevitably became, you know. So it's a case of hoping to spend more quality rehearsal time with people. But at the moment, it's not really the case.
You had many responses to Day of the Stranger in terms of either sales or in terms of feedback, reviews and things like that. What were they like?
Day of the Stranger was really unsurprisingly mixed. I mean, some people really just could not get with it. It was far too low budget. It was far too ridiculous. And, you know, the internet types, they've all been very unkind, which, you know, just it does not bother me one bit. You know, when you put out a piece of work in a public forum, you've just got to expect it, because like there's films being made for like 200 grand now, which people call low budget trash, you know, and I think, well, what chance do we stand if that's the case? But the people that do get it really get it, and you know, they understand that it's, you know, one of those kind of little oddities, you know. And I think the fact that it's just, it's a British Western just really kind of helps sell it, you know. And even in like the trailer, I put that it was like, you know, the first guerrilla British no budget acid Western or something like that. And I just think, well, that's all you need to know. So you're either on board with it or you aren't, but you know. Unsurprisingly mixed, so I'm really happy about that. It's nice in a way to have people trash you, because it means it's not, you don't get that idea that everyone's just telling you what you want to hear a lot, you know. Some people will just tell you what you don't want to hear.
Yeah, you know, if you're getting bad reviews, at least the battle lines are drawn, you know, you're on one side and they're on the other side, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And I do rather have people be upfront, because like I said with Day of the Stranger, there's so much about it that I'm not happy with. I've got a really awful relationship with the film. Some days I actually think, oh, well, that ain't too bad. Then other days I'm just like, oh, my God, you know. And, you know, that's all down to just my shortcomings and whatnot. And I think every creator does have their problems with their work. You know, it's just an inevitable thing.
Well, as you've alluded to it earlier as well, it kind of shapes where you took it next. So that was, I think that was the earliest thing I saw that you've done. So you've steered away from the dialogue scenes more onto the use of narrators, and the actors are not speaking at all, or they're acting without dialogue. And I think that's an interesting shift, right? So it's given you a stylistic shift into a new direction. And I think that's interesting how you got those, as particularly filmmakers on the level that we're working at, where it's always a mix of your artistic intentions and the actual logistics of getting the thing made. So you're kind of having to negotiate that path all the way around when you haven't got the money to make those films. So it has pushed you in a particular direction. There's definitely an evolution from Day of the Stranger to Bella and Witch Helm and into Pocket Film with Superstitions, I think.
I think that's because, again, yeah, I just realised I can't make a film like Day of the Stranger again in that way that we made it, because it just won't work, you know. And, you know, if you're balancing newcomers versus experienced actors, you're going to get a mixed bag. I mean, I don't mind that, don't get me wrong. I mean, everyone's having a go. But I think sometimes to kind of heighten the experience of the low-budget film, maybe just take the dialogue out of the situation and get someone with a good voice to drive it. And then the actors might be pulling all the right faces, and then they might just, you know, they might open their mouth and kill the scene. I mean, you know. And then plus, I wasn't working with any decent sound gear, so if I was to go to these locations and set up all the sound gear, I'd run out of time before I'd shot anything, you know. So, again, it takes out a lot of those anxieties, I think, and then you're able to steer it in a way that you want to, because you're taking out, you know, the idea of Foley and everything and stuff like that, and then you're just thinking about making sure the score works and whatnot.
Is it literally just you on set? Camera, sound, lighting, everything? Or how many people generally do you have on set for, say, Pocket Film with Superstitions?
Oh, right. So there's me with the camera, and then there's the actors, and then there's a couple of people running around helping tie things together and making sure, you know, that actors are looked after. So, like, yesterday, my other half, Sarah, she was there, and she was brilliant. You know, she was able to take care of, like, Danny if she had any kind of, like, hair and beauty, or, like, concerns or something like that, because I, you know, wouldn't have a clue. And plus it gives, like, you know, it gives the girls someone to, you know, relate to there, you know, so they don't have just a bunch of lads around. And then my friend James, again, he was running around, making sure everyone was topped up on coffee and whatnot. And absolutely invaluable, you know. These are the people you need on set, you know, to help let it just go smoothly, whilst I just worry about all the shots, you know, and whatnot. Which really I could do with farming out to a DP, because I'm not the best technician in the world. Some decent shots I have mucked up big time. And I guess working with all these filters now and all this kind of silence effects, I'm able to hide a lot of that. So whilst I'm still working at my level before I've kind of sorted myself out and got a good DP involved and whatnot, then I'll make them in a way that I feels just, you know, dictates the level of filmmaker I'm working at and gives a good result as a result of those limitations, you know.
How long have you got to go before you've finished shooting Pocket Film with Superstitions?
Well, we're about 75, maybe 80% done. Still a couple of biggish you know, sequences to do. Again, all dictated on the locations that we want. So hopefully I'll get to find those, because I don't want it to become a case of having to just cut these sequences, because there's a certain flow to it where I think, well, one scene falls into the next, and I don't want to take that out and have to kind of bodge something in there. Because, you know, a lot of filmmaking is bodging as well. And it's just amazing when people watch it and they just, it just doesn't register, you know, whilst you're watching it and you're thinking, oh, that's that bit there, you know, oh, this is that bit there. But no, it's about 75% done. So we've still got a way to go. And I guess, like, we've been, you know, we've been pushed back a bit as well because of the last couple of years. And we'll just, hopefully, I can get it done for the end of next year, maybe. We'll see. Again, like you, what you mentioned earlier about a lot of my work being very heavily reliant on post, it all, with this, it really does depend on how far I go with that, because I'm coming up with all these little trick ideas, much like what we were saying earlier about adding like matted shots in and stuff like that. You know, I'll look at a shot and think, oh, I can revise that and make it look even better, you know. So it depends. It all depends. I just hope it doesn't take another 3 to 5 years, you know.
What point do you say enough's enough?
I think that's a good question, you know. I mean, because every film I've put out, I don't see as like technically 100% finished, you know, because there's always stuff to do on them. And I guess you just have to, well, I guess a deadline helps with I mean, with Day of the Stranger, we screened at Horror on Sea, January 2020. So that gave me a deadline. I was thinking that would be it then. But then I suppose after that, you could always go back and keep editing. But, you know, I think it just became a point where it became a monkey on my back. And I just thought, now is enough and enough's enough. And I need the space on my computer to crack on with what I want to do. I mean, I don't know if the film's ever gone out of hand like that for you, but, you know.
Several times. And several times I haven't had the, I've lost the enthusiasm to finish. You know, I'd say with mine, every 10 ideas I have, I might write one script. With every 10 scripts that get written, I might put one into production. With some of them, yeah. It used to be the case with every 5 or 6 that I put into production, one would get finished. But these were kind of shorts, and I think I've turned a little bit of a corner with that, really, with the last couple of years with getting stuff made. And it always takes a little bit longer than I wanted to. I don't spend as much time in post as what you do, doing the tricks. I have a different style, but it's if I've got one thing that's frustrating about me, it's my inability to turn films over quite as quickly. There's that guy, Joe Swanberg. He made all those mumblecore films in the last kind of 10, 15 years. You know, at one point he made like 6 feature films in a year,
wow,
or something like that. And I think he was acting in them, and they're only very small. They're kind of small dramas, you know, shot on video with him and his actor friends and stuff, and semi-improvised. So it's a very different style. But that kind of being that prolific is really quite attractive to me. I don't think I'll ever get there, to be perfectly honest. But that's
I completely sympathise. I feel the same. Every film, I mean, a lot of films are designed to be turned over quite quickly as well. Like Day of the Stranger, again, was meant to be like a 2-hander in one location, and that failed miserably, you know. And yeah, I'd love to. I mean, the way you see certain filmmakers release their third feature, and you look how well produced they are as well, and you just think, how, you know, they've got the magic touch. So eventually, I'd like to, you know, fall into a model of being able to, you know, recycle a budget, you know, have it come back to you and recycle it and use the same model and start with maybe a chamber piece with about 5 characters and just hope for a really like week or two of filming, you know, rather than 3 years and whatnot.
Yeah, that seems to be the plans that I'm trying to bake in. And I tried it a couple of years ago. I made a film called Grace. It was about 48 minutes long, and that was just one location. That was 3 days of filming and a cast of 3. But it was great that we could shoot it in just a short space of time. But it did, the problem with that is that because you spend less time filming it, you have to do a bit more of constructing the film in the edit and saving a few things in the edit, which that you would have if you just spent more time shooting and maybe writing it. You say, I mean, there's always problems. If you spend less time writing it, you spend more time on set. You spend not enough time on set, you spend more time editing it. And that's always the dilemma. And when you haven't got the money, you haven't got the budget, and you can't pay people the money to stay on set and come on set every day, then it's one of those problems, I think.
It really is. And I think it doesn't matter what level you're making films at, you're always going to be running into a new problem, you know. So you've just got to live with problems. And, you know, I guess when you do make, eventually do make that film with a bit more of a budget, you might even find that money isn't everything, you know, and it's just a solid crew is all you need, really. And just, and as long as they're having a good time, then, you know, all is good. I have to ask everybody after a shoot that I've done is I've asked if they've had fun, because that's, I mean, I hate the idea of someone just slaving away at doing something that they don't want to do for me, you know, for my for my benefit, you know. So as long as everyone's having a good experience.
So maybe this is the wrong question to ask you now, since you're only 75% through Pocket Film with Superstitions, but do you have any plans after that point? Are you coming up with ideas all the other time? What's your five-year plan?
Well, it would be nice to have a plan where I can turn over at least one a year. You know, I'm not going to go mad and say three a year, but, you know, one decent film a year, maybe even one every 2 years even, because I'm torn. I don't know about yourself, but you're always looking at where you sit in the indie landscape. You know, where am I? What part of the map am I, you know? And, you know, very much on the fringes, but I'm thinking, well, I'm happy offering something completely different to what, you know, a lot of people are bringing to the table. So, but that can, I suppose, can only get you so far if, you know, you won't get those films distributed because they're far too weird. And there are a lot of distribution opportunities in the US for any kind of film, but over here, it's a very tight margin, isn't it, of kind of content they want over in the UK. So part of me wants to make those kind of more commercially driven films, because it's filmmaking at the end of the day. I don't begrudge anyone who does. But then the other half of me just has to ask myself why I love film in the first place and why I love indie in the first place. And that's why I'm making the kind of weird, offbeat little films I am, because I just think, well, it's truer to what I want rather than, you know, what somebody else wants. And, you know, maybe I can just fuse the two somehow and bring something a bit more deliverable, but also weird. So hopefully, I don't know, maybe a progression in terms of something going a little bit more accessible. I don't know. I haven't really thought about it in those terms, but just seeing what ideas I've got I can bat around that will make it more, I suppose, widely appreciated. I'm not sure. I'm always constantly, you know, looking at where I am on the map and thinking, should I just carry on doing this?
Well, look, Tom, yeah, I just want to say thanks very much for agreeing to this conversation. I really loved the films that you sent me to watch. I find them really inspiring. And one thing I really like about talking to guys who are operating on your level is the fact that you're doing it off your own back, being really creative and doing something with nothing. And I find that far more inspiring sometimes than watching higher budgeted stuff.
The invention, when you see the invention on screen as well, it's just so heartening to see, isn't it? You know, even if you can see the springs and the seams, and I love it all. You know, you're watching people be creative and inventive and, you know, dancing around obstacles. It's great. It really is. But I guess, you know, none of us get any younger, do we? So we don't want to keep struggling through it all. We want to do it with more ease.
Well, Tom, thanks very much for that. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, if that was all right, mate, then I'm happy, you know.
Thank you to Tom Lee Rutter for joining me on this episode of Newton Talks. And you can visit Tom's YouTube page to see some of his trailers and short films in the link in the description. Day of the Stranger is also available via Darkside Releasing on both Blu-ray and Video On Demand. And thanks to you for listening. Newton Talks will return.